Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, the whole gang, Pamela Shattuck, Marvin Gowron, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. How are you guys?
Hey, Paula.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Pamela.
Hi, you lovelies.
Hi, lovelies. Oh, so good to hear your voices. Wow. Well, welcome to the show, everyone. Welcome to our listeners on the board. Last week we interviewed Mike Butler and Carol Engel Enright, and man, what a great interview that was. And we learned all about their school, SOSIS, School of Statesmanship, Stewardship, and Service. It was so great. I want to go to that school. I can't wait for them to put it online. So that'll be coming this summer, they think. Right now, if you want to attend that school, you have to go to Longmont, Colorado. And even I can't do that too easily because it's a 35-minute drive from me, probably 40 minutes if they're in the northern parts of Longmont. But such a beautiful place Longmont is. So I love it up there. I'm so glad they're doing that. That was a great interview. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I sure did. But the week before that, though, we started on a paper 9, Relation of the Infinite Spirit to the Universe. And we read the intro, and we didn't get any further. It was such a good introduction.
There's a lot in that intro.
Right. A strange thing occurred.
A strange thing.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We concluded that this is the last of the Divine Counselor papers, at least in the first series of the book. And so he's swinging for the fences here. And it's pretty darn good. So we'll continue with this paper today, section 1, which is, let me find it. I scrolled all the way down to the Divine Counselor part, the attributes of the third source and center. which of course is some infinite spirit, our beautiful infinite spirit, the third person of Trinity.
Yes.
And when we did our show a couple weeks ago, Roy Healy on the board said, you know, he made the comment, a comment about the word infinity, and said, I love to ponder that word infinity. And I said, well, Roy, why don't you call in, Roy, and tell us what you think about the word infinity? Because we were talking about that, that it's mentioned in that introduction. So I think Roy is on with us if you want to put him on, Andre.
Will do. Give me a moment.
He shows up in all ones. Which is the earmark.
You may have to wait a moment till I am on the board. I've been away from the board for a minute or two. So if you can do it, that'd be great.
I can put him on. I can put him on.
Go ahead.
Let's see. Roy, is it you?
This is Roy. Can
Roy.
You hear me?
Yes.
You can hear me.
Yeah.
How's my sound?
We can.
I'm having some difficulty. Okay, that's great. I'm having some challenges with my sound on my computer, so I'm not sure how I'm coming across. Yes, hello. Good morning, everyone.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
It's
yes.
Lovely
good.
To be here.
You're coming across great, Roy.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the way from Canada.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. From Bonnie, British Columbia.
Yeah.
Everything going good for you
there? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, everything is just great. Spring has sprung, and the snow is all melting away. Right now, a lot of us, much of the town and all of the country around us is a skating rink. But, you know, we wear spikes on our shoes, so and we can still walk on water. So that's great.
That's right.
Okay. So we were talking about infinity quite a bit a couple weeks ago, and you had mentioned on the board that you really love that word and ponder that the meaning of that word a lot. And I invited you to tell us what you think about it. And,
okay. In 25 words or less.
Words or less. Right.
Oh, well, that's too bad because I've got a whole script here.
I have a whole script.
Okay, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version then if you want.
No. I was being silly. You know, read everything you prepared. Please.
Oh, be careful with it.
Be careful what you ask for. Huh?
Yeah, you don't want to give a politician or a minister the microphone, that's for sure. Okay, so basically what it is, what I have, the reason I wrote that in is I've been working on this for an episode of a video series that I've been doing, and the name of this particular little grouping of episodes is called The Infinite and Finite Games, and it's based around a book that was written by Professor James Carse, who's a professor of religious studies, I think, at New York University, and it's really good, but it's anyway, it's really, really good. So I'm exploring some of this, particularly given the quote in paper 110, section 3, paragraph 1, if anybody wants to look that up, it says, adjusters are playing the sacred and superb game of the ages. They are engaged in one of the supreme adventures of time and space, and how happy they are when your cooperation permits them to lend assistance in your short struggles of time as they continue to prosecute their larger task of eternity. So that paragraph, that quote, inspired, so I had a little meditation on that. And what immediately came to me were that this speaks to the whispers of the ancient past. and speaks to the ascendant glorious future that lies ahead and the present be here now moment of eternity. So I thought, well, that's pretty good. I should write this down. And I just started writing, and I'll just read a little bit. Okay, it says, in the pages of the Urantia book, the notions of the infinite and the infinity are painted with broad cosmic strokes that reach across the canvas of existence, touching the whispers of an ancient past, resonating with the vibrant be here now moment of the eternal present, and casting forward to hint at an ascending future ripe with adventure and discovery. These concepts serve as both a foundation and an aspiration for understanding the nature of the cosmos and our place within it. Yet to fully appreciate the vastness of the infinite and the breadth of infinity, one must also consider the offspring of the finite universe. The finite universe represents the realm of time and space, where matter, energy, and life forms evolve. It is a domain of stage upon which the drama of existence unfolds, bounded by the physical laws that govern movement, growth, and decay. Unlike the infinite, which transcends the limitations of temporal and spatial constraints, the finite is characterized by its boundaries, its beginnings, and its susceptibility to change and progress. Whispers of an ancient echo through the concept of the infinite harken back to a source without beginning or end. This timeless wellspring of all existence invites us to consider our origins, not as points in time, but as part of a continuum that stretches back into the unfathomable depths of eternity. The infinite, in its boundless perfection, encompasses all possibilities, offering a foundation upon which the tapestry of the finite universe is woven. And that goes on and on and on and on.
Wow.
Oh, that is beautiful. So poetic.
Yeah, well, that's inspired by the Urantia papers, isn't it? I mean,
there's
just a cosmic poetry that flows through the pages of that. It's just mind-blowing all the time. So,
you know, can I share a couple of paragraphs with you that I read recently that what you were sharing, Roy, really reminds me of these two paragraphs. And they talk about the way language is used. I mean, I think the Urantia book is the only piece of writing I've ever encountered that with simple words really has the power to take us outside of time and space, to give us a taste of what they're trying to hint at. Mm-hmm. And these two paragraphs for me, I remember whenever I read them, I don't know how to describe it. They do something to me. They just affect me in a really deep way. And I'm curious if, and there's so, the use of the language is really transporting. Anyways, this is from, it's paper 118, Supreme and Ultimate Time and Space, from the Supreme Papers. And it's from the section Time and Eternity. This is paragraph 5 and 8. From this section. So they say, in the maturity of the developing self, they're describing this experience we will go through that begins to get us outside, begins to move us outside of time and space. So we can begin to grasp, we can begin to move beyond it. That's what they're describing here. In the maturity of the developing self, the past and future are brought together to illuminate the true meaning of the present. As the self matures, it reaches further and further back. So they're talking about when we've been alive for millions of years, even billions of years, right? As the self matures, it reaches further and further back into the past for experience, while its wisdom forecasts seek to penetrate deeper and deeper into the unknown future. And as the conceiving self extends this reach, ever further into both past and future, so does judgment become less and less dependent on the momentary present. In this way, does decision action begin to escape the fetters of the moving present while it begins to take on the aspects of past-future significance. The time unit of immaturity concentrates meaning value into the present moment in such a way as to divorce the present of its true relationship to the not present, the past future. Time unit of maturity is proportioned so to reveal the coordinate relationship of past, present, future, that the self begins to gain insight into the wholeness of events. It's such an interesting term, to gain insight into the wholeness of events, begins to view the landscape of time from the panoramic perspective of broadened horizons, begins perhaps to suspect that non-beginning, non-ending, eternal continuum, the fragments of which are called time.
Oh, I got to write that in.
Those two paragraphs are worth the price of admission.
Those are the two that you said have a deep and profound effect on you every time you read them, Marvin.
Every time I read them, it begins to move me a little bit outside of time and space limitations. I begin to get how they see things, you know? It's astounding use of language.
And how God can see the end from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's all happening simultaneously. To God, that blows my mind to think about that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that the older I get, the more I think about the past. I don't know if you guys experience that too, but it's funny. I go right back to when I was 5 or 6 or 7. And I really go back to that place, you know, and just ponder things that were said, you know, what I did, who I was, how I am still that person, essentially. You know, I once told my children that people are like trees. If you cut a tree down, every ring of its existence is still there. And the tender sapling is still at the core. That tender baby tree is still always there. I think people are like that. We're like that. So in that way, we're carrying with us simultaneously everything, that the totality of who we are, you know? Imagine a million years from now what that will feel like.
Well, there's one other short paragraph, and I'm going to have a question for you, Paula. And really for all of us. It says, in between those two paragraphs, it says, to become mature is to live more intensely in the present, at the same time escaping from the limitations of the present. The plans of maturity are founded on past experience. Are coming into being in the present in such manner as to enhance the values of the future. So my question is, you know, you're talking about as you get older, you go back and you feel the value of your history more and more deeply. And I don't know about you guys, I've started to have more of an experience, and it's really only in the last 5-10 years really, of thinking a lot about the past, but having more of an ability to project in a coherent way out ahead into the future and try to make plans and develop activities related to more and more of future orientation. And in a very, very limited way, I think maybe we start to experience, even down here, this beginning to escape the fetters of the moving present, that we begin to stretch further and further back and mine our history for its riches, and we begin to be able to project and say, you know, this is how I think things may unfold out ahead. But do you guys mm-hmm. have that experience? Have you had that experience more as you move through life? I'm curious.
Maybe that's what foresight is, Marvin.
Yeah.
You say know? It again.
Maybe that's what foresight is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is Roy still on?
No, Roy, you hung up. Darn it.
Yeah, darn it. I wanted to find out what Roy had to say about all this. So.
Yeah. Well, maybe he'll call back. Oh, too late, he
says. Yeah, too late.
It's all right, Roy. It was great to hear your voice this morning.
It was. Beautiful.
And thanks for getting us on the topic of eternity. Wow.
One thing, Marvin, your question there. One of the things I do think about sometimes is the book's statement that comes with a plan that our adjuster actually arrives in our minds with some kind of a plan for our life. And I've always found that very intriguing. And I look at my own life, and I can't imagine how that could have been anyone's plan. You know, the various twists and turns and ups and downs and all of that. You know, the specifics, in other words, taking this job, taking that job, relationship.
Well,
but what I wanted to add to that, what I wanted to say about that is what I've kind of come, that the plan isn't about turning left at the next corner. The plan is about sort of value comprehension and understanding of reality on levels that can move forward, you know, to take, you know, into the next life. Plan is really about, you know, maybe character achievements and value realizations and that sort of thing, not like what career did you have. So if you guys agree with that, but that's the only way I can really understand that statement.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, actually. That quote, I've thought a lot about it as well. And the wording they use is actually quite precise. It's 110:2:1, paper 110, section 2, paragraph 1. And they say, thus, the thought adjusters indwell human minds. When the thought adjusters indwell human minds, they bring with them the model careers, the ideal lives as determined and foreordained by themselves and the personalized adjusters of Divinington, which have been certified by the personalized adjuster of Urantia. And then there's this language. Thus they begin work with a definite and predetermined plan for the intellectual and spiritual development of their subjects. But it is not incumbent upon any human being to accept this plan. So I don't think they come with a plan like, you know, Chuck is going to move from the Bay Area to Boulder roughly this time in his life. I don't think that's what it's about. The plan is for intellectual and spiritual development. So
right,
I think
exactly.
they're looking to how to grow us spiritually and intellectually. And the stuff of life is just grist for the mill for them. It can come and go. They're looking for decisions and key realizations and soul development. I think that's more the plan they carry. But I'd love to get your guys' thoughts on this too. It's a great question, Chuck.
Well, Gary posted something. I want to share what Gary posted on the board as a quote from 118:3:2. The more truth you know, the more truth you are. The more of the past you can understand, and of the future you can comprehend. So that was a great addition to this conversation.
That's a good summary.
Pretty much.
A good summary.
A good summary.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
I, to the point about what level of detail the thought adjuster comes in with a plan, what level of detail that is, I don't think they can plan it too stringently because they have to allow for free will. And I agree that, you know, they give you, they have a basic, they know you. They know what it's going to take. I mean, let's face it, they know all of your antecedents. They know you and all of your parents, 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 right? They know you from time immemorial. You are the culmination of a long chain of events that happened behind you. And now here you are. And they know, you know, inherently, your inherent strengths and weaknesses. And so I think they can pretty much, or without a doubt, they can definitely, a thought adjuster can definitely project what it's going to take to get you into the future.
Don't they say something
and if
about
you'll
you.
Cooperate at all. Go ahead, Chuck.
No, I was going to say, don't they say something about the adjuster having a mind mind model?
A mind model, yeah.
Did they practice on?
That makes sense. I don't remember that, but it makes total sense to me.
A
mind model.
That?
Wow.
I'm sure that's in there.
We get to
Yes. Paper 108.
Is it is it hyphened? Oh, good.
No,
Kim, can you put it on?
Yes.
Yeah, they can. When they apply to be, you know, when a human being is going to receive a thought adjuster, they say a whole bunch of them apply. And they say they have a working model of the mind and the genetics. And they can tell something about the intellectual and spiritual capacity of the subject that they're volunteering to indwell. And they work with a mind, they work with a mind model. That much I remember.
Yeah,
this mind model.
108, section 1, paragraph 8. I can just read that real quick if you want.
Go ahead, Chuck.
Bam posted that on the board. Bam,
yeah.
you're just sharp. Holy cow.
She's right on it.
Pam had you guys just completely in the dust, man. She left you.
I'm in the future.
Are you driving a Tesla? Because you've left these guys in the dust.
You are like
what, what kind of search engine are you driving?
Yeah.
Many horsepower. Yes.
Yeah. Many horsepower.
Anyway, go ahead and read it. Read it, Chuck.
So starting with 108.17, with these facts before them, meaning the data that they have, it is our belief that the monitors freely volunteer for assignment. Probably more than one adjuster volunteers. Perhaps the supervising personalized orders select from this group of volunteering adjusters the one best suited to the task of spiritualizing and eternalizing the personality of the mortal candidate. That's a good little summary of their, of their job right there. Spiritualizing and eternalizing the personality of the mortal candidate. In parenthesis, they say, in the assignment of the adjusters, the sex of the creature is of no consideration. And then here's where they talk about the mind model. They say, the short time intervening between the volunteering and the actual dispatch of the adjuster is presumably spent in the Divinington schools of the personalized monitors, where a working pattern of the waiting mortal mind is utilized in instructing the assigned adjuster as to the most effective plans for personality approach and mind spiritualization. This mind model is formulated through a combination of data supplied by the Super Universe Reflectivity Service. At least this is our understanding. A belief which we hold as the result of putting together information secured by contact with many personalized adjusters throughout the long universe careers of the solitary messengers.
Wow.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me that here we all are in this soup, and they can have a mind model. And know pretty much, you know, but when you get all of these free will beings in one place, especially on a place like this planet, all bets are off pretty much. I mean, there's no way of knowing what any one human will encounter in life, for sure, I don't think. Especially when you get all of these other free will humans in the same place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this planet is mm-hmm. particularly troubling to me because of what we do to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's the difficult, their greatest difficulty on this world is the way we treat each other as, you know, humans. I imagine that breaks
yeah.
their heart, actually. The celestials who, they invest so much effort, as this book reveals, how much effort they invest in this adventure of eternity for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, how easily it is for us to trip each other up.
Yeah, and so much of it is probably because we don't have the ability to forecast forward. Because those that don't have the revelation are stuck with a low ceiling of expectation.
Hmm. Right.
You know, and
One of the main
reasons think about,
why it's so important.
When you talk about how people treat each other, what you're really talking about are relationships, right, primarily?
Right, exactly.
Of all kinds, parental,
mm-hmm.
friends, you know,
group to group, country to country,
all
kinds person
of
to person.
So our relationships are really our value laboratory. I mean, it's in our
mm-hmm.
relationships where we really put values into practice, or we find out that we have to, or that we discover values. So I don't know. I mean, there is, of course, like you say, a lot of unfortunate episodes mixed into that. But there's an importance to it too, because overcoming those problems is, you know, part of the whole purpose of this life. And we can't expect to become non-savages, you know, just like overnight.
Well,
yeah, that's true.
Experience.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just stick in one more sentence just for this conversation is really moving some really neat places, but there's one more sentence from this paragraph in 110 that's very related to the one you shared, Chuck, about the plan and what their purpose is, and also about the question, like you were saying, Paula, how much cooperation do we give them? You know, we have free will. So the picture I have is that they come with a plan, but they're constantly adjusting course in response to the decisions we're making. So they make this statement.
Mm-hmm.
They say, you are all subjects of predestination, but it is not foreordained that you must accept this divine predestination. You are at full liberty to reject any part or all of the thought adjusters program. And then there's this really interesting sentence, which for me gives me a lot more insight as to what it is they're trying to accomplish. They say it is their mission to effect such mind changes and to make such spiritual adjustments as you may willingly and intelligently authorize, to the end that they may mm. gain more influence over the personality directionization. That's really an interesting description. So their plan is a plan of transforming the way our minds work and our spiritual sensitivity, sensing mechanism in a sense, so that they can more and more influence us in the course that we take. And that really... You know, for me, it relates to the shift from thought changer to thought adjuster to thought controller. What they're hoping to do is to really move more into the driver's seat with our profound cooperation. You know, when we say to God, it's my will that your will be done. I want your way to prevail in my life. You know, so please show me. And that's what they're trying to accomplish is our yielding more. And allowing them more
to the divine way.
To direct us, to show us the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have experienced my way, and it isn't as good as your way.
Your ways are higher than my ways.
Yeah, there you go.
My way hurts my way hurts a lot.
Yeah, my way. Your thoughts are harder than my thoughts. Was that Isaiah?
Well, great.
Was that Isaiah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he's great.
Well, that was a great segue into section one, the attributes of the third source and center. And I guess as we read it, we'll figure out what, you know, and I thank you, Roy, for taking us on that journey of infinity.
Yes.
You know, it reminds me of that great song, Andre, you'll appreciate this, by Mark Cohn. I'm thinking about eternity, some kind of ecstasy got a hold on me. that's a lyric.
Bruce Coburn,
I'm wondering it's Bruce Coburn, right.
Yeah.
Such a great song. Thinking about eternity, some kind of ecstasy got a hold on me.
Amen.
I think that's, you know, to me, that your Rancho book makes us think about these things, and it is ecstatic.
Yeah.
There's something about it, romancing the universe. So, once again, romancing eternity. So, shall
and
we
infinity.
Start with the, huh? And infinity, right? Eternity and
they
infinity.
They kind of go together.
Yeah, that's true. So, should we start with section one?
Yeah,
to the third
I'm happy to
center?
Jump in.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead, Andre.
Rich stuff.
Rich stuff.
Section one, attributes of the third source and center. The third source and center is known by many names, all designative of relationship and in recognition of function. He is the personality coordinate and divine equal of God the Son and God the Father. As the infinite spirit, he is an omnipresent spiritual influence. As the universal manipulator, he is the ancestor of the power control creatures and the activator of the cosmic forces of space. As the conjoint actor, he is the joint representative and partnership executive of the Father, Son. As the absolute mind, he is the source of the endowment of intellect throughout the universes. As the God of action, parent, ancestor of motion, change, and relationship. Some of the attributes of the third source and center are derived from the Father, some from the Son, while still others are not observed to be actively and personally present in either the Father or the Son. Attributes that can hardly be explained except by assuming that the Father-Son partnership, which eternalizes the third source and center, consistently functions in consonance with and in recognition of the eternal fact of the absoluteness of paradise. The conjoint creator embodies the fullness of the combined and infinite concept of the first and second persons of deity. While you envisage the Father as an original creator and the Son as a spiritual administrator, you should think of the third source and center as a universal coordinator, a minister of unlimited cooperation. The conjoint actor is the correlator of all actual reality. He is the deity repository of the Father's thought and the Son's word, and in action is eternally regardful of the material absoluteness of the central isle. Paradise Trinity has ordained the universal order of progress. And the providence of God is the domain of the conjoint creator and the evolving supreme being. No actual or actualizing reality can escape eventual relationship with the third source and center. The universal Father presides over the realms of pre-energy, pre-spirit, and personality. The eternal Son dominates the spheres of spiritual activities. The presence of the Isle of Paradise unifies the domain of physical energy and materializing power.
The conjoint actor operates not only as an infinite spirit representing the sun, but also as a universal manipulator of the forces and energies of paradise, thus bringing into existence the universal and absolute mind. The conjoint actor functions throughout the grand universe as a positive and distinct personality, especially in the higher spheres of spiritual values, physical energy relationships, and true mind meanings. He functions specifically wherever and whenever energy and spirit associate, that is, and interact. He dominates all reactions with mind, wields great power in the spiritual world, and exerts a mighty influence over energy and matter. At all times, the third source is expressive of the nature of the first source and center. The third source and center perfectly and without qualification shares the omnipresence of the first source and center, sometimes being called the omnipresent spirit. Peculiar and very personal manner, the God of mind shares the omniscience of the universal Father and his eternal Son. The knowledge of the spirit is profound and complete. The conjoint creator manifests certain phases of the omnipotence of the universal Father, but is actually omnipotent only in the domain of mind. The third person of deity is the intellectual center and the universal administrator of the mind realms. Herein is he absolute. His sovereignty is unqualified. The conjoint actor seems to be motivated by the father-son partnership, but all his actions appear to recognize the father-paradise relationship. At times and in certain functions, he seems to compensate for the incompleteness of the development of the experiential deities, God the Supreme and God the Ultimate. And herein is an infinite mystery, that the infinite simultaneously revealed his infinity in the sun and as paradise. And then there springs into existence a being equal to God in divinity, reflective of the sun's spiritual nature, and capable of activating the paradise pattern, a being provisionally subordinate in sovereignty, but in many ways apparently the most versatile in action. And such apparent superiority in action is disclosed in an attribute of the third source and center, which is superior even to physical gravity, the universal manifestation of the Isle of Paradise.
Wow.
In addition to this super control of energy and things physical, the infinite spirit is superbly endowed with those attributes of patience, mercy, and love, which are so exquisitely revealed in his spiritual ministry. Spirit is supremely competent to minister love and to overshadow justice with mercy. God the Spirit possesses all the supernal kindness and merciful affection of the original and eternal Son. The universe of your origin is being forged out between the anvil of justice and the hammer of suffering. But those who wield the hammer are the children of mercy, the spirit offspring of the infinite spirit.
Wow, what a guy.
Like I said,
isn't
I'm into the fences.
He's balancing a lot of balls in the air.
Yeah, you get the sense when you read this. What an extraordinary being, deity.
Yeah, you can
we're
say
discussing
that.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really no words, is there? One of the problems with this book is there's not a word good enough to, there's not an adjective good enough to describe sometimes what you just read. And this is clearly that case, the infinite spirit. And the God of mind really struck me. He's the God of mind. That's the only time I remember seeing that. I imagine they've said it in other ways, and they didn't capitalize mind. But what struck me as you read this, Andre, was closely related spirit and mind are. What do you guys think?
It's a reality that issues from pre-existent spiritual reality, if you regard the father-son relationship as ancestral to the spirit, then there must be that same kind of ancestral relationship of mind with spirit. And we get some interesting insights that way when they talk about thought adjusters as being pre-mind, pre-spirit, pre-energy. There seems to be this whole source relationship that runs from the Father through the Son to the Spirit. And an interesting change in how reality is manifest that way. And I'm only thankful that it manifests in mind in such a way that we have a mind to use. Because Lord knows where we would be without just even these little feeble minds we have to use.
And that's true. And these minds that are on loan to us, I think there's a place in the book that says the mind is on loan to you. It gives you an apparatus to plug in to that, you know, amazing cosmic mind, which we are all in. I mean, this clearly gives you a sense of the omnipresent.
Okay.
Cosmic mind.
Well, the scaling. When you talk about our minds being small, I mean, that's sort of true. I mean, compared to the mind of the infinite, you know, there's this downstepping, but that's, you know, it's provided by our mother spirit, as I understand it.
Right.
You know, through the infinite spirit, through the master spirit, for this super universe, and then finally to the mother spirit, and then she modifies it, downsteps it to make it available in a physical organism. If you think about that, what's involved in evolving a physical organism that can receive mind is the mind's not physical. You know, you think about it like a smartphone. Now it can operate in a Wi-Fi environment, right? And we think that's so cool, you know, which it is.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of reflection of what's already true about us. You know, that our mind is not in our head. You know, we have the equipment to receive mind in our head, you know, if you want to put it in those terms. I mean, our brain and nervous system, they say, has the capacity to respond to mind ministry. So, but that brain and nervous system has to be there, has to be in place to be the antenna to receive mind.
Okay, so let's look at paragraph 914 because, well, I'll just read it. The Universal Father presides over the realms of pre-energy, pre-spirit, and personality. The Eternal Son dominates the spheres of spiritual activities. The presence of the Isle of Paradise unifies the domain of physical energy and materializing power. The conjoint actor operates not only as an infinite spirit representing the Son, but also as a universal manipulator of the forces and energies of paradise, thus bringing into existence the universal and absolute mind.
Yeah.
So it's the manipulating the forces and energies of paradise is how mind is brought forth. Right? Isn't that what they're saying?
Yeah. And it's what it's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So
mind is like a, is it a fabric? How would you define mind?
I think look down at paragraph 6, because I think that maybe helps to explain this a little bit, where they say the conjoint actor seems to be motivated by the father-son partnership, but all his actions appear to recognize the father-paradise relationship. So maybe we could conclude that mind somehow comes out of this father-paradise relationship.
Right.
The father has a contribution to make into that manifestation. I mean, I'm just guessing, but...
And, you know, I appreciate your point about the attenuation that has to take place before it gets to us, and Andre's point, too, that, you know, what occurred to me when you said that was, it's like electricity. If you get a surge in power, what ends up happening? Everything gets burned out. Everything burned out. Which is probably what would happen to us if we were to suddenly experience, well, I think the book says that if we were to go to paradise right now, we would just probably disintegrate in the energy, pure energy of it. Our circuits would burn up. It would burn us up. So the mother spirit, by the time it gets to her, she attenuates it even further into, you know, into the six adjutant mind spirits. And then that makes it receivable by us.
And right.
So we are, mind is the wholeness of who we are, and that is the spirit, that is the infinite spirit coming to us. The just the pure power of the deities. It seems to me like the infinite spirit is just a compilation of all of that, that the immense power that comes from the Father and the Son. Mm-hmm. And then the spirit takes it and gives it to everything, makes it available to everything.
Activates the God of action, activates all of these.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
The God of action, the God of mind.
That's
yeah.
But that wow. The line you took us through, though, Pam, is still kind of intrigued by that.
Yeah.
they give us a wonderful definition of what mind is elsewhere in the book, in the Thought Adjuster papers in 111.2.2, they talk and they say, the material mind of mortal man is the cosmic loom that carries the Marantia fabrics. Oh, did I copy the wrong one? I did. But that's
the
a nice one
loom.
Anyway. no, this is the one. It's throughout the mind functions of cosmic intelligence. This is 2-1, mind functions of cosmic intelligence. The totality of mind is dominant over the parts of intellectual function. Mind, in its essence, is functional unity. Therefore, does mind never fail to manifest this constitutive unity, even when hampered and hindered by the unwise actions and choices of a misguided self. And this unity of mind invariably seeks for spirit coordination on all levels of its association with selves of will, dignity, and ascension prerogatives.
Hmm.
So functional unity.
That speaks to my point about being in a soup with other humans, too, because the unwise actions and choices of your own misguided self, but I would add, and misguided others as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The mind finds that unity, or a way to unify.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm struggling with a little bit is how you derive mind from the physical level. You know, they say that the infinite spirit's the manipulator of the forces and energies of paradise, thus bringing into existence a universal and absolute mind. So, you know, I'm accustomed to thinking of matter, mind, and spirit being on distinct and somewhat separate but related, you know, interacting levels. And in that sense, just reading it maybe out of context, it sounds like they bring mind into existence from the material level. From the Yeah. Forces and
well,
energy.
Well, they certainly bring it.
Yes. Yes. Right.
They certainly bring it into existence in relationship to the material level. I mean, all of these things, remember, are co-eternal, and at a high level, they are functionally very close to each other. Paradise matter is not as indistinguishable from paradise spirit. They say, and we can hardly tell you anything about a reality which is only distinguishable in name. Speaking of paradise spirit and paradise monoda. So when you have that kind of close relationship between the two realities at that level, and it's only on lower levels that there's greater and greater divergence that's manifest. You know, for us, it's the difficulty is we have very little experience with spiritual reality. And so matter appears to be it from the human perspective. With mind seeking to interpret reality entirely on a material level. And they would be disabusing us of that notion and saying, well, the only reason you can do that is because mind is preexistent to matter and on your level was projected as a reality that could unify functionally. The realities of spirit and matter could take that which is directive energy, that which is motivational energy, that which qualifies the inner life and those realities which have to do with what we want, you know, and bring them in relationship to realities that have no relationship to what we want, but can be utilized by us. I mean, matter is a tool.
Mind is the unifier of spirit and matter, just as the god of action, the manipulator, the relationship god is the unifier of these from the paradise point of view. So it's like he's ever the unifier of reality, of those aspects of reality. That's what I hear you saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's always functioning as unity. And go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just a little farther down that same paragraph, they say the infinite spirit or he functions specifically wherever and whenever energy and spirit associate and interact.
Yes.
He dominates all reactions with mind and goes on from there. Wields great power in the spiritual world. So, that, again, we're looking at a unity of all these levels. But he exerts a mighty influence over energy and matter. I mean, somebody's got to do it, right?
Better.
I guess so.
They better.
Exactly.
But at all times, it's expressive of the nature of the first source and center. So that's kind of an echo of what they said. They say a little lower about it appears this his actions appear to recognize the father paradise relationship. So the father is the highest spirit, and then that has to be brought into relationship with the you know the stuff of reality.
Yeah, you know that part confused me, the father paradise, because when the sun came into existence, paradise came into existence. So it almost seems like it should say the father's son paradise.
Well, the first part partnership refers to the father-son partnership.
Right.
So I think the differentiating thing there is the idea of, you know, the father paradise relationship, whatever, you know, however that manifests, is a relationship of energy. It's a relationship of the organization and control of everything that is non-spiritual. And the relationship with the Son is that relationship which encompasses everything that is spiritual.
It's spirit,
whether you want to use the word control there, there is over control, but it's not about over control. It's on that aspect of things, it's about love and mercy and those that are important personal relationships. And I love what Isadora put in the chat, that ultimately this is all about love. It is unfathomable love. You know, when you go back to the beginning and what the I am is in its essence and in unified, you know, the Father I am must be love. And that reality must be what we are striving to realize more and more, primarily through giving it away, through letting it pass through us, through loving others. And we get to learn something about a reality that comes before mind and spirit and matter.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's
that
it's
actually elevates all
soup.
Those realities.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the container. It's the container of all those. Yeah. Good point. Way to go, Lady I.
Yeah. You're here.
There we go. We've got a new moniker for you, Isadora. Your Lady I.
Lady I. Yeah, I love that. Well, and I want to point out that that second paragraph, Andre, after the first one you read, that you almost read, you started and then you backed up, 111.2.2, the material mind of mortal man is the cosmic gloom that carries the Marantia fabrics on which the indwelling thought adjuster threads the spirit patterns of a universe character of enduring values and divine meanings, a surviving soul of ultimate destiny and unending career, a potential finaliter.
Yeah,
that's pure poetry to me. And when you when you read that, you get in your mind, you see the loom, right? And you see the golden threads of value and divine meanings that the weaver is weaving, and they sparkle out, you know, on the, in the whole. They are what makes you real. And they're like the threads of eternity. They're, you know, speaking of infinity and eternity, they're the threads that endure. It's the stuff that goes on that he's weaving in for you. He's helping you find the value and the meaning, which, you know, you can't see that necessarily. Love is a prime example of it. You can't prove it. But you know it's there. It's like developing a personal life philosophy. This works for me. I can count on it. It's real. It's what defines who I am in the inner life. It's what makes me real. Not just a thing. Not just something that whose days are numbered, right? A material thing.
Right.
That, like all material things, even mountains, even oceans, will morph and change and even go away. But not this.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not this eternal reality that the grand weaver is weaving into the loom of my mortal mind.
Yeah.
You
it's
know,
like this new
on that cosmic loom.
It's so beautiful. I love it. I'm glad you shared that, Paula, because as you were reading it, it made me think of this webbing of spirit pattern. Is what's happening is it's dissolving our materiality, and we're being replaced with spirit essence, which is really what the entire career is going to be about. Somehow we will still have our entity, whatever that is, but it'll
it'll be more of a non-material entity. So I don't know. It just, I hadn't thought of
pure spirit, pure mind.
As dissolving our materiality, you know. Like, so,
but that's clearly,
you know,
what's happening in the Melancha life. That's clearly what's taking place.
Yeah. I mean, we should be able to walk through walls, right?
I wonder.
Well, we can eventually.
I think
eventually,
so. The divine counselor says he can't even perceive the walls.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
You know, I think it's a divine counselor that says that, or at least one of it, you know.
I think it is. Yeah, well, it says somebody, the divine counselor that is with me, can perceive even less of this.
Oh, there you go.
Right. That is with me. Right. He perceives even less of the structure of this, which leads you to wonder, what is it they see?
Mm-hmm.
You know? It makes sense then, if we were to be transported to paradise, we would be completely senseless. We wouldn't perceive anything.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
because we are so much material right now. We are so decidedly material, so dependent on those realities. But it makes you think, well, we could tap in to that cosmic mind more. That's what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
To really reach up, to tap into that pure essence of mind. You know, Gary said on the board earlier, he posted, which is a quote. This is a quote, by the way, Gary, that has always intrigued me, and I just absolutely love it, but I ponder it endlessly because of, you know, this the idea that some people don't even believe in God. And so this quote comes to me often: to assume that the universe can be known, that it is intelligible, is to assume that the universe is mind-made and personality-managed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's a goodie.
That's a goodie. You know, that one is really intriguing to me because... why is that true? Let me just ask that. I don't mean to derail the conversation. It's just that statement is always intriguing to me. Why is that true?
Well, it's not self-evident. You know, to for instance, atheists. But when you consider anything that you encounter that's organized in just human, man-made kinds of things. You don't come across a bridge and assume that the bridge grew there. You look at it and you pay attention to it and you say, whoa, that's great. What a great bridge. Look how it's designed. Somebody put it there, you know, in order for it to be there, because it doesn't match the rest of the surroundings. The rest of the surroundings, you can take for granted, somehow always were there. And yet what they're telling you is that, no. Just because it looks to you like it always was there and always would have been there, when you investigate further into that thing, you see similar, even greater kinds of organization that is there, and design and aspects of the function of those things that, even though you can't understand them, and even though they appear to function in such a way that they are automatic and function on their own, that belies the reality of how they got there. And, you know, we're given, you know, the insight, highly unusual for a planet in our stage of evolution, but we're given the insight that, in fact, matter and energy and all of those things are managed from the transcendental level, that are managed by the architects of the master universe, that these things have been designed on that level. And that's part of the reason it's undiscoverable by us, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we can't figure that kind of stuff out. But just things like, I mean, you think about what we've discovered about speed of light, that the speed of light is a constant. Regardless of how fast, for instance, something that is traveling is emitting light, light emitting from that object is also traveling at the speed of light, but would not be perceived by any other kind of outside observer to be traveling at anything other than the speed of light. Instead, what you see are frequency changes and that kind of thing. That's a very simplistic view of that, and I don't mean to get into the weeds with it, but that indicates that the speed of light is a constant on the transcendental level, that it's somehow functioning, mm-hmm. you know, at mm-hmm. it's able to function as a constant no matter what, because it issues from a reality on the transcendental level and has something to do with the master architect.
Yes, as a law of the universe, yes.
Hmm. Yeah.
I love that bridge analogy, mm-hmm. Andre. That is really mm-hmm. good. Because I can take that and say, you know, you come to a bridge. To come to this bridge, you can assume that this bridge can be known. Yeah, you can step on it. You can cross over it. You can know it. Then you can further assume that it's intelligible or created by intelligence, like you said, like you illustrated in your analogy, mm-hmm. and I loved it. It was great. Yeah, and for us on this planet in isolation, it's more difficult to assume that the universe is intelligible and mind-made and personality-managed because we can't experience much of it yet.
Yeah.
On a normal planet, we probably could experience way more of it, and that way it would be easy to make that assumption. It's more difficult to make that assumption here. It's more of a faith step.
Well, it is. Yeah. And, you know, maybe going one step further from that, that's something definitely in the realm of engineering. In the realm of art, you wouldn't go up to the Mona Lisa and say, wow, how did that appear on canvas?
That's good.
You know,
that's good.
You look at it, you say, the first question that comes up is, who's the artist? Oh, Leonardo da Vinci. You know, well, that's so well known, that's not the best example, but there you could come up to a piece of art that you didn't know that was well executed, and you would come up and you'd say, God, that's beautiful. I wonder who the artist is. And there's a place in the Urantia book, and I'll find the quote unless Pam beats me to it. And it's the one that says, well, it's in the Celestial Artisan Papers, and you can't truly know a work of art, or you can't truly know something except by understanding the artist or the engineer or whatever behind it. They don't say the engineer, but it's in knowing the artist. And part of that is, what if I look at the universe as a work of art by the master artist who is our deity, our father, the son, the spirit, all functioning together in their own various ways? This gives me insight. If I look at the universe that way, I'm now not looking at a dead universe. I'm looking at a living cosmos. I'm looking at something that has personality behind it. And to an atheist, this is anathema because they say, well, you've got no proof of that. But again, they're stuck in the empirical, as though science and the empirical has the only voice to say something about anything, and that philosophical and religious voices have nothing to say, that the technique of knowledge through logic and through faith, real methods of getting knowledge of things, which is essentially that's a huge distortion. If I can only learn about life and everything through science, I have entirely a materialistically biased view of everything. And in fact, then my philosophy is going to be distorted toward that. And that's a distortion, not toward reality, but toward a sort of kind of unreality. Because if there is something behind things, I'm going to miss it. If the only way I can discern that is through the faith that there was an artist or a scientist or a loving God behind it. And that's really why they're saying we have to have faith in God. Because without faith in God, we don't get to recognize reality as it actually is.
No, we see it darkly. We see it skewed, like you said, distorted. Gary, you know, I have to say this. Gary posted a quote just now, and I looked it up at the same exact time.
Oh, cool.
He posted it before I did, but I had already queued it all up.
That's the quote. He recognized the quote that I was looking for. That's the one.
Well, and then Pam has another one, too. But this is the one you were referring to. Right?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Right. Yeah. And, well, no, Pam's is right along. It's just five paragraphs down from that one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's read them. This is 195, 718. 195 is such an amazing paper. Oh, my gosh. It's just so packed full of truth, beauty, and goodness. But, okay, 195, 718. Any scientific interpretation of the material universe is valueless unless it provides due recognition for the scientist. No appreciation of art is genuine unless it accords recognition to the artist. No evaluation of morals is worthwhile unless it includes the moralist. No recognition of philosophy is edifying if it ignores the philosopher. And religion cannot exist without the real experience of the religionist who, in and through this very experience, is seeking to find God and to know him. Likewise, is the universe of universes without significance apart from the I am, the infinite God who made it and unceasingly manages it. It's so poignant to your thought, Andre, about the grand canvas and the master strokes of our precious Creator. And we're all a part of that great work of art that he's creating and is ongoing, obviously. And the section we read, you know, section one really speaks to that as well. And then here's 195, 723, just down a little bit from the one I just read. The artist, not art, demonstrates the existence of the transient Malancha world intervening between material existence and spiritual liberty.
Yeah.
That really brings it home. I mean, that ties it together with...
And there's mystery there, too. There's quite, you know, okay, so we, you know, they at one point they define art as material Marantia, and I mean at least as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
But this underscores again that earlier part, the idea that it doesn't happen except for the artist. Therefore, the artist in executing the art is demonstrating the reality of something beyond the material, spirit in this case, making its way into that material. Of course, an interweaving of material and spiritual by the definition we've been given in this revelation is Marantia. That is what gives us the ability to bridge upward toward spirit reality eventually someday.
Mm.
But isn't that interesting? It's again focusing on the idea that without personality, without a desire for this, or a determination to move in this direction, or the will toward this, there is no reality to or no meaning or value to all of these things that we discover. That's the implication.
Mm.
And that's hard to convey to a materialist, to an atheist.
Right.
And they can dismiss it,
well,
frankly. They can dismiss it and they can say, well, hoo-ha, you know, you're just living in your own world, and 'cause I know nothing of this, and there's nothing that demonstrates itself to me this way, and nothing will to, and it's not because, I mean, there are some atheists that really are looking for values. There are some that really do care and unconsciously look toward this, but ignore God because of the primitive ways in which they've been taught about God. Or been shown God, and so they have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. But there's another group that just simply can't bear themselves not to be the center of the universe, to be their own God, effectively, and to assert that there's any God that displaces them from the center of their cosmos will not be accepted.
The reality of volition, I think, has to be recognized sooner or later. I mean, that's one of the issues with atheism, is it doesn't recognize how volition has functioned in the creation of reality. So they're left with this position, what I sometimes call the things just happen theory of reality, where, things just happen. And that can't take you very far. You know, how do things just happen? They just happen? What?
Yeah.
So, and what's missing in that is volition, that this is all done on purpose, that there's a creative intent, which is ultimately associated with personality and will and all those kinds of things, and purposeful action.
You get to participate in the grand design.
Right.
You get to participate in the,
And
here's the God of action, right? Here's the God of action moving through time and space to touch you, to create something, like our friend David Cantor says, that will echo into eternity.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do with that? What are we going to do with that grand divine creative energy that's moving across the face of the universe of universes? And we can take that, we can tap into that and channel it into creative energy that'll create something lasts, even ourselves, right? Even ourselves, because we last. We have that potential. We become our own great work of art by the things we choose to focus on, by the things we choose to value. We become that work of art that we're wanting to create. And we're doing it in partnership with God, the greatest creator of all, the greatest creative energy there is, and his infinite spirit.
Yeah, energy. It's the recognition that we're related to God, you know, the concept of sonship, daughtership, as well, of course. But the fact that we're actually literally the children of God is what gives us eternal life. That's the key to eternity, really, is that realization. Because once you realize, oh, wow, I'm related to the Creator. I mean, related like a family member, kind of, you know, or relations. I talk about relations, relatives, you know, that we're relatives of God. You know, that's a
truly
that's kind of an exciting concept, because it speaks to our nature. If we're related to God, then God's nature must somehow be in us as well, if we can, you know, find it and figure it out.
Well, we're rich. Our Father owns the universe, right? We're all rich. Rich beyond our wildest dreams.
Well, they talk
there
about
you go.
Inheritance. our inheritance is there for the asking.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's just a detail that I wanted to point out in the paragraph 7 I think might be interesting. I mean, just to clarify what they're saying in this paragraph. I don't know if I need to read the whole paragraph. Maybe I will. Anyway, they say, and herein is an infinite mystery. Any paragraph that starts out that way has got to be good, right?
We love it.
And herein is an infinite mystery, that the infinite simultaneously revealed his infinity in the Son and as paradise, in the Son and as paradise. And then there springs into existence a being equal to God in divinity, reflective of the Son's spiritual nature and capable of activating the paradise pattern, a being provisionally subordinate in sovereignty, but in many ways apparently the most versatile in action. And such an apparent superiority in action is disclosed in an attribute of the third source and center, and they don't mention what it is, which is superior even to physical gravity. But that's a big hint. The universal manifestation of the Isle of Paradise. So I think what they're pointing to there is anti-gravity, that's an attribute of the third source and center, and that
right.
demonstrates the superiority in action of the third source and center over these material manifestations.
Isn't that interesting as well? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that in creating the spirit in the presence of the Son in paradise, you know, the Father and the Son, because the spirit has personality, is given priority over something that came before him. I mean, literally has over control over that which issues from paradise, gravity, and can transcend that in some ways. And we can only wonder why that's important. We don't have any real conception of why that's important. These days, we mainly have magical ideas about it as a result of films like Avatar and, you know, how cool that would be. but in terms of the reality of
it. Well, there are places where they talk about the functioning of anti-gravity in different scenarios.
They do, but it's still hard to imagine. What is your conception of the reality of how that's valuable to over-control?
Well, there's occasions when it needs to be somehow set aside or canceled so something else can happen. I don't know. We'd have to look at that those sections where they talk about it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for all we know, they might talk about it a little bit later where they talk about attributes further in this paper.
Might even be in this paper, Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of like a little hint or a preview of something they're going to talk about more.
A little foreshadowing,
His attribute of activation, is that what you would, how would you term it? What would you call that attribute? They don't really say, right?
What, anti-gravity?
Well, do they say anti-gravity?
Well, I think that's what that paragraph's referring to. The fact that the third source and center can cancel paradise gravity means that the infinite spirit is on a higher level than paradise. So it's superior even to physical gravity, or paradise, in other words.
Huh. Wow.
It's pretty interesting.
Up above it says, also a universal manipulator of the forces and energies of paradise. So,
yeah. Well, section 3, the universal manipulator, is where they talk about it.
Right. So
they talk about anti-gravity.
So the spirit is super additive to the Father and the Son, obviously. I mean, that they both give superpowers to the spirit. You know, it's like.
But interestingly, only the infinite spirit seems to have this particular ability or capability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's appropriate to being the God of action, you know, because gravity is, you know, part of action. And to be able to, how do they put that, annul, I think is one of the words they use. Yeah, anti-gravity can annul gravity within a local frame.
Mm.
And I don't remember if the infinite spirit passes that ability on to others in the infinite spirit lineage. It may be, that may be true. I'd have to go back and look.
It's just mind-boggling. The more you look at this section, the more mind-boggling it becomes. Like, for instance, at the end of the first paragraph, as the God of action, he is the apparent ancestor of motion, change, and relationship. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the one attribute they pointed out?
You'd be the one with the switch if it was needed. You know, the kill
with
switch
the
on gravity.
Oh,
he would
switch.
Be the one to have the kill switch on gravity if that was necessary.
Wow.
In a local frame.
Yeah, right. Right.
Because that's
talk about
his
having
domain.
Your finger on the button. Yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. Anyway. It's sort of activator and deactivator. Deactivator when necessary. There's
and
a
again,
manipulator.
On mind, paragraph 5 ends with the conjoint creator manifests certain phases of the omnipotence of the universal father, but it's actually omnipotent only in the domain of mind. The third person of deity is the intellectual center and the universal administrator of the mind realms. Herein he is absolute. His sovereignty is unqualified. Wow.
Well, you know, that's kind of, I hate to jump ahead, but in this first paragraph of section 3, they say that the Isle of Paradise is the source and substance of physical gravity, and that should be sufficient to inform you that gravity is one of the most real in italics and eternally dependable things in the whole physical universe of universes. Gravity cannot be modified or annulled except by the forces and energies conjointly sponsored by the Father and the Son, which have been entrusted to and are functionally associated with the person of the third source and center. And they say the infinite spirit possesses a unique and amazing power, anti-gravity in italics.
Okay, there it is.
This power is not functionally, observably present in either the Father or the Son. This ability to withstand the pull of material gravity inherent in the third source is revealed in the personal reactions of the conjoint actor to certain phases of universe relationships. And this unique attribute is transmissible. Here we go. Is transmissible to certain of the higher powers, higher personalities, rather, of the infinite spirit.
Wow.
Anyway, then you go on to talk more about it. But that language there about how it's the most real and eternally dependable thing in the whole physical universe, I mean, it has to be that way, obviously, to, you know, for things to be stable and predictable. But yet there's this allowance for annulling it if that becomes necessary. But only through the infinite spirit.
Amazingly powerful being. Deity. Of course. But, you know, I mean, it's just, like I said, mind-boggling. It looks like, Andre, we have a caller who'd like to say something.
I think I know who this is, you know, from, I don't think we even need to screen this caller. I will just say hello. Is this either Joe or Cindy Foreman?
This is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Paul.
Nice to hear you after so many years. Jesus. My goodness.
It's been a long time. It's been a long time. Hey,
yeah,
I was,
so good to hear your voice.
I was calling in for a couple of reasons, and one of them was that our friend Chris Halverson and I had a discussion about gravity at one point. And Chris advised me that there is an anomaly, and I can't remember. I think it's like the Neptune paradox or gravitational paradox. And he said that, you know, given all we know about gravity, we pretty good, well, have a good handle on it. But he said there is a peculiar phenomenon that has been measured, I believe, just beyond the orbit of Neptune. And he said they measure gravity multiple times over and over, and it appears there is more gravitational force starting at that point. They have to calculate orbits and trajectories and everything. And he said there is a difference, a more gravitational force at that point, and no one can explain it. And I'm thinking if this concept of, and now this is Joe speculating, okay, but if this concept of anti-gravity is transmissible, why couldn't it be transmissible to the master power controllers and used it in a way that might suffice for populating a planet?
That makes sense.
Hard to know. Describe the phenomenon again.
He said that, you know, given the number of interplanetary spacecraft, they have to be able to measure all of the gravitational forces very precisely as it affects that craft. And one of the things that they have discovered is there has to be an adjustment on the gravitational pull, presumably of the sun and planets and everything else. There is an increase just beyond the planet Neptune. It is a like a Lagrange point, only it's not a Lagrange point. It's a gravitational point. And I can't remember the exact first name, but the suffix is paradox, which tells me nobody has any clue as to why this is occurring. But in the discussion of the attribute of anti-gravity, you know, given consideration of a planet that's potentially populated, why couldn't this element of control be associated with, for example, a master power controller who would be able, or his subsidiaries, who would be able to bestow this characteristic on this particular place for this particular time, because it suits their needs?
Joe,
just an idea off the cuff. But Joe, my buddy Chris would probably very quickly verify what I just talked about. It's one of those things that a PhD astrophysicist would know, but would probably escape a person like myself. But he told me that this anomaly exists.
Is that where the Kuiper Belt begins?
I couldn't tell you. He said just beyond, and I believe it was Neptune.
That's approximately where the Kuiper Belt began. And there's that anomaly of course, Pluto's strange orbit and Neptune's strange orbit, but they impinge upon the Kuiper Belt. Interesting.
That was one idea I wanted to throw out there.
It kind of goes to what you're saying, perhaps. This is in 29419. They say of all the master physical controllers assigned to the inhabited worlds, the mechanical controllers are by far the most powerful, possessing the living endowment of anti-gravity in excess of all other beings. Each controller has a gravity resistance equaled only by enormous spheres revolving at tremendous velocity. Ten of these controllers are now stationed on Urantia, and one of their most important planetary activities is to facilitate the departure of Serapis transports. In so functioning, all 10 of the mechanical controllers act in unison with a battery of 1,000 energy transmitters to provide the initial momentum for the Serapis departure. They seem to be implying that that involves anti-gravity in some way to get you know, get the transports and off the planet. I don't know. They don't say that specifically, but it's by being in the same paragraph, sort of by implication. But anyway, this kind of goes with what you're saying, I think, Joe.
Yeah.
These are
one other idea, if I may.
Planets, and they have anti-gravity ability. Anyway.
One other idea, if I can. You know, we were going through the paper, and there is a discussion of actuality, and I have thought of the concept of free will, and this is just kind of off the top of my head, but it's convenient for me to think of free will as an innate, as an ability to take from potentiality and make it into actuality and add to the supreme. That free will is a prerogative of only certain beings, and we are fortunate to have that, as they refer to dignity of free will. And and I'm just, this is Joe's idea, but I'm just wondering, is free will actually the capacity to pull from the absolute and turn it from potentiality into actuality? Because in an, and I can't recall the exact paper, but it says that as finaliters progress, they leave behind a trail of actuality.
Yeah, actualized reality, yeah.
Actualized reality.
And this is just a concept that I, you know, I found intriguing, and I can't specifically put my finger on a reference, but it makes sense and it seems to fit correctly. So anyway, I would really enjoy if you would have a comment, and I won't take up any more of your time. I appreciate the ability to participate with your group. Thank you so much.
Yay.
Well, it's wonderful to reconnect,
you,
Joe.
Yeah.
Good talking to you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Well, you know, I have to agree that with your Joe's pondering about free will, because we draw from all of the great potentials. There's a potential for evil too. And even we know from the teachings of the book that even the Michaels could potentially choose other than they do. None of them ever have. But they could, because that potential is there. So they draw, we're all drawing from that potential when we choose, when we have the ability to choose. The possibilities of choice are infinite. And we get to do that all the way along, all the way. Each experience we have is unique to us in a way. I mean, and how we react to it, whatever it is, you know, whatever we choose in that moment is a unique choice in that moment of all the potential choices there are.
It almost sounds like there's a there's a gravity. There's some kind of gravity associated with free will. You know, an attractiveness, an ability to affect possibility in any number of directions.
Yeah, it's like a wake you leave. It's your wake.
Yeah, but it. It's got to be an attractive force within free will itself, right? To pull forward, to pull into you something that is in a possible reality in your future that you want to affect. So who knows? Maybe it's tied in with mind, you know, free will.
With
mind
gravity.
With mind gravity.
Spirit,
yeah.
Spirit gravity and personality gravity. So
yeah.
All of those.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Anti-gravity, though, I think, only functions in relation to physical gravity.
Right.
Well, the anti-gravity that they're revealing, if it would be hard to conceive of whether there would be any mind anti-gravity or spirit anti-gravity,
right,
or personality anti-gravity and what the use of that might be. But isn't it interesting that we get this revelation of the reality of at least material anti-gravity, something related to the Isle of Paradise?
Yeah. Well, whenever I think of anti-gravity, I think of light. Light seems to be able to manage gravity pretty well. Light seems to be able to escape gravity.
Well, yeah, depending on what you look at in physical, you know, the idea of a black hole, of course, misnamed, they're really the dark islands of space that the book is revealing. There is a material core there that are so gravitationally intense that light cannot escape from those places. And in fact, our light is drawn in.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be, I mean, mind, obviously. When we think about spirit gravity, then what, you know, what's pulling that? What, you know, spirit gravity then is must be mind gravity, right? And we know that certain of our... No,
they're separate. They're definitely distinguished, and I think we have time to perhaps delve into that briefly. But
have an anti-gravity kind of effect to them. They transcend gravity. And one of them could be our thoughts, our prayers. But go ahead. What were you going to say about?
Spiritual gravity centers in the sun. And, you know, they talk about measurements. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, this is in paper 12. Let me just look here quickly. They talk about a bunch of things here and there we go. 12.3. So if we go to paper 12 and look at the third section, we'll see how they differentiate these three kinds of gravity. This is the the section on universal gravity. Does somebody want to read it?
Go ahead. This is from paper 12, The Universe of Universes. So I just want to say that.
Right. Universal gravity, section 3. All forms of force energy, material, mindful, or spiritual, are alike subject to those grasps, those universal presences, which we call gravity. Personality also is responsive to gravity, to the Father's exclusive circuit. But though the circuit is exclusive to the Father, he is not excluded from other circuits. The Universal Father is infinite and acts over all four absolute gravity circuits in the Master Universe. So we get the revelation that they're all absolute. 1, the personality gravity of the Universal Father. 2, the spirit gravity of the Eternal Son. 3, the mind gravity of the conjoined actor. 4, the cosmic gravity of the Isle of Paradise. These four circuits are not related to the Nether Paradise Force Center. They are neither force, energy, nor power circuits. They are absolute presence circuits, and like God, independent of time and space. In this connection, it is interesting to record certain observations made on Universa during recent millenniums by the Corps of Gravity Researchers. This expert group of workers has arrived at the following conclusions regarding the different gravity systems of the Master Universe. 1, physical gravity. Having formulated an estimate of the summation of the entire physical gravity capacity of the grand universe, they have laboriously effected a comparison of this finding with the estimated total of absolute gravity presence now operative. These calculations indicate that the total gravity action of the grand universe is a very small part of the estimated gravity pull of paradise, computed on the basis of the gravity response of basic physical units of universe matter. These investigators reached the amazing conclusion that the central universe and the surrounding seven superuniverses are at the present time making use of only about 5% of the actual functioning of the paradise absolute gravity grasp. In other words, at the present moment, about 95% of the active cosmic gravity action of the Isle of Paradise, computed on this totality theory, is engaged in controlling material systems beyond the borders of the present organized universes. These calculations all refer to absolute gravity. Linear gravity is an interactive phenomena which can be computed only by knowing the actual paradise gravity. That's a revelation. Two, spiritual gravity. By the same technique of comparative estimation and calculation, these researchers have explored the present reaction capacity of spirit gravity. And with the operation of solitary messengers and other spirit personalities have arrived at the summation of the active spirit gravity of the second source and center. And it is most instructive to note that they find about the same value for the actual and functional presence of spirit gravity in the grand universe that they postulate for the present total of active spirit gravity. In other words, at the present time, practically the entire spirit gravity of the eternal sun, computed on this theory of totality, is observable as functioning in the grand universe. If these findings are dependable, we may conclude that the universes now evolving in outer space are at the present time wholly non-spiritual. And if this is true, it would satisfactorily explain why spirit-endowed beings are in possession of little or no information about these vast energy manifestations, aside from knowing the fact of their physical existence. And then there's an interesting thing about mind gravity. Three, mind gravity. By these same principles of comparative computation, these experts have attacked the problem of mind gravity presence and response. The mind unit of estimation was arrived at by averaging three material and three spiritual types of mentality. Although the type of mind found in the power directors and their associates proved to be a disturbing factor in the effort to arrive at a basic unit for mind gravity estimation. There was little to impede the estimation of the present capacity of the third source and center for mind gravity function in accordance with this theory of totality. Although the findings in this instance are not so conclusive as in the estimates of physical and spirit gravity, they are comparatively considered very instructive, even intriguing. These investigators deduce that about 85% of the mind gravity response to the intellectual drawing power of the conjoint actor takes origin in the existing grand universe. This would suggest the possibility that mind activities are involved in connection with the observable physical activities now in progress throughout the realms of outer space. While this estimate is probably far from accurate, it accords in principle with our belief that intelligent force organizers are at present directing universe evolution in the space levels beyond the present outer limits of the grand universe. Whatever the nature of this postulated intelligence, it is apparently not spirit gravity responsive. But all these computations are at best estimates based on assumed laws. We think they are fairly reliable. Even if a few spirit beings were located in outer space, their collective presence would not markedly influence calculations involving such enormous measurements. Mm-hmm. Personality gravity is non-computable. We recognize the circuit but we cannot measure either qualitative or quantitative realities responsive thereto. And elsewhere, wow. We might note that they indicate that the solitary messengers are sent out on excursions every once in a while into the outer space levels to determine some things. So there would be indication that there would be some spirit gravity in operation, but it would be so negligible that, again, they wouldn't be detectable.
And that's what they were saying, right? When they refer to outer space, they're talking about beyond the organized universe of universes. Is that correct?
Well, not beyond the organized universe, beyond the grand universe, into the first, second, or other outer space levels,
Right. Wow. What a section. Well, thanks for reading that. That was a bonus, folks. That was a bonus.
Yeah, that was a
we
bonus.
Just got in another whole section. But so intriguing. We're talking about gravity, right? To be able to go to that. I'm so glad you referred to that. Four different kinds of gravity. They're very clear.
And they're all absolute.
Them as circuits. And they're all absolute.
Yeah.
They're all absolute.
Yeah. Meaning we are
But they
in
do
their
indicate
graph.
That there's linear phenomenon with all of them. You know, just like we know that we are held to the Earth because of linear gravity, and they say that, you know, you could compute this most successfully based on absolute gravity. There's also the attraction of personalities to each other, both mindal and spirit attraction. Mm. And we can imagine that as we grow spiritually, there will be more and more attractions of quality that allow for functioning we can only imagine.
Wow, what an adventure.
Another interesting aspect of this, if I could just point this out quickly, I know we're running out of time, but a couple of paragraphs in that same paper, they refer to these gravities, types of these gravity circuits as absolute presence circuits.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect of their function. So when you think about the spirit gravity of the eternal sun, that's the presence of the eternal sun. As well as the spirit drawing power. They kind of go together. They function together somehow.
Wow.
So like the earth, we can feel the presence of the earth because if we jump up in the air, we come down again.
Yeah.
And that's
inescapable.
That's our way of feeling the presence of the earth.
Right.
I think your point. Go ahead, Pam.
Go on.
Well, the point about what it takes to get us off even with the seraphim really speaks to how powerful that gravity is.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Power directors really need to focus their attention and get us off the planet even in spirit form.
Yeah, apparently.
Well, and we're down to our last minute.
Last minute, go ahead, Pam.
Finish.
Oh,
yeah, you get the last thought, my dear.
Well, they just referred to the presence of paradise. And you know,
true.
It's like we think of beings with presence. I do anyway. So that's just that kind of made me go, what? So we'll deal with that next week.
When we read section 2, the omnipresent spirit.
Yes, that's going to be a good section.
Yeah, that's a great segue. Well, thank you guys. What a deep, wonderful conversation. I'm so glad we had our callers, Roy and Joe. It was wonderful to hear you guys. And thanks to all our listeners on the board. We love you. We always get so much from your wonderful comments. How great. I look forward to it always. So. Thank you, dear friend. You might have noticed Marvin dropped off. I don't know. I don't know why. Or if we knew he was
going to
drop off.
He indicated that he was going to have some things in the background this morning. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Well, we missed him, but it was a great conversation, and I appreciate you guys so much. Have a wonderful week.
Yes.
Indeed. Okay. See you next week.
All right.
See you next
Happy
week.
Happy St. Patrick's Day tomorrow for anybody who celebrates.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Same body.
Love y'all.
Well.
Love you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.